Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
I see how they get their information. And I can't believe that they know it. They haven't done the work necessary, haven't done the checks necessary, haven't done the care necessary. I have a great suspicion that they don't know that this stuff is, don't know, and they're intimidating people.
The great end has spoken. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Who are you? Who are you?
A very bad man.
I'm a very good man. Good man.
Just a very bad wizard.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm Tam Lou Summers from the University of Houston.
And I'm David Pizarro from Cornell University.
This is a podcast with me, a philosopher, and Dave, a psychologist and noted anti-Semite.
Every time you say that you're a philosopher, I feel like quoting the Princess Bride and saying, I don't think that you know what that, understand what that word really means.
I don't think that word means what you think
what
it
you
means.
What you think it means, that's right.
Yeah. And on this show, we discuss issues in science and ethics, and we do it in a fairly informal way, as if both of us were in a bar. And sometimes we're actually drinking, so...
You are. Somebody made note of that in our iTunes review.
I don't think they made note that it was me that was doing the drinking. I think they said both of us. But actually, it was a listener, Cheryl Namias, who I thought described the spirit of the show perfectly. She said, sitting here with Eddie, that's her husband, listening to one of your shows.
Actual philosopher Eddie Namias.
Yeah, this is an actual philosopher Eddie Namias. Listening to one of your shows, 10 minutes in, we've learned about meth, the Big Lebowski, and swingers. Waiting for some philosophy.
I think she's still there with like a couple of tears down her eyes, like days later, still waiting for the philosophy.
So let's not keep Cheryl and anyone else who may be listening, if there are any of you out there, let's not keep you waiting another 10 minutes, and let's start with today's episode.
They must be the most contented people in the world. They have no crime, no punishment, no violence, no laws, no police, judges, rulers, or bosses. They believe that the gods put only good and useful things on the earth for them to use. In this world of theirs, nothing is bad or evil. The one characteristic which really makes the Bushmen different from all the other races on earth is the fact that they have no sense of ownership at all. Where they live, there's really nothing you can own. Only trees and grass and animals. They live in a gentle world.
So that was a clip from the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy, a movie I actually haven't seen in a long time. And the reason
I haven't seen since I was a kid.
I remember
12 years old or something.
Yeah.
I remember it was a Coke bottle, a black guy.
There was some Bushman, right? Is that a racist?
That's racist. That's racist.
I think that's their legitimate name. I feel like when you say Bushman, it sounds much more racist than when I say
he was an actual Bushman.
Yes, some Saharan Africa. Who finds a Coke bottle and hijinks ensue. This is actually a topic that we've touched on before. There's a deep concern. The concern is, could it be that we're not really building up a science of the human mind? We're just building up a science of, you know, college sophomores. Traditionally, this has been a concern about, well, how do you know that you can conclude anything about human nature from looking at college undergraduates? Those guys, there's no guarantee that a college undergraduate has the same psychology as, say, a Bushman.
Or even just an American adult.
Right, right. You know, so,
or someone in East Asia, someone in the Arab countries or Israel or whatever. I mean, there's no reason to think necessarily, a priori, to use a philosophical term. see?
Ceteris paribus or something mutatis.
Pro tanto.
But recently, there's an even deeper concern, which is that not only... are, is this population not representative? That in fact it might be the least representative if the entire population of the Earth is taken into consideration. And a couple of years ago, some psychologists with sort of an anthropological bent published a paper called The Weirdest People in the World. And this offered up a pretty serious criticism of the current state of the behavioral sciences and its focus on Western, educated, industrialized, rich democracies.
Which is what WEIRD stands for.
Which is what WEIRD stands for. And the point that they made is not only are our subjects, our participants in many of our psychological studies, not representative of the world, but in fact, they are exactly the opposite. They are the weirdest people in the world.
They are the most exotic subculture that you could possibly study.
Right.
Great. And we should give some names here. So that the lead author is a man named Joseph Henrich. He's originally in anthropology. He got his PhD in anthropology and is now at University of British Columbia in the psychology department and also economics, because apparently anthropology is so divided as a field right now between the biological anthropologists and the cultural anthropologists that there was no way they could agree to have Henrich in there.
Yeah, and then Steve Heine and Aaron Orenzion, all of these people are at University of British Columbia, and we'll put a link with this paper actually, because I think that it's really a great paper and it's been influential, and it's a weird thing, its influence keeps sort of getting bigger.
It gets right to the heart of what it is that especially you guys are doing as psychologists.
I mean, as people who actually gather the data that you just talked
about. And also though, what we do as philosophers, especially philosophers who try to have their work be empirically informed. So whenever you guys put out one of your studies and the, you know, and your conclusions or discussions start, you know, raving about this new discovery you've made about human nature, philosophers will take that seriously sometimes to support their own ethical theory or undermine an opponent's ethical
theory. Which is rarely represents progress by many philosophers who would just state their own intuition. Usually.
That's true. Yes. So let's talk about what Henrich, you know, what led him to do cross-cultural behavioral studies in the first place. He was part of this group of psychologists, I think, studying under the anthropologist Robert Boyd. What they were looking to do is to discredit the Homo economicus theory of human behavior to show that people really don't behave in ways that are just trying to promote immediate self-interest. And they were doing this experiment, and they started out doing this on American undergraduates, like everybody else does. I don't know if we've talked about the ultimatum game, but let's just describe it again really quickly. Yeah. The ultimatum game, I'm given $20, and if I'm the proposer, which is randomly selected, and I can now offer Dave any amount of the $20 from 1 to 20. And then Dave can either accept the money and walk away with however much money I've proposed to him, or he can reject the offer and neither of us will get any money.
Right.
Right. So Homo economicus, which is the theory which predicts that human beings will always act to promote their own self-interest, would predict, right, that I would offer you $1. And that you would accept that $1. I would offer you $1 because it's the least amount of money that I can offer. And you would accept it because it's $1 is better than no dollar.
Right. So imagine you ask people, is having $1 better or worse or equivalent to having $0, right? You would expect most people would say, of course, having $1 is better than $0, except for that they're willing to actually forego the $1 to punish the proposer for making what they perceive as an unfair offer. And it should be noted that this view of Homo economicus, or this standard rationality account of rationality as self-interest, the way that economists describe it, only would predict that this might be the case in the interaction of two strangers. Because if, in fact, I know that it's Tamler and we're friends and we're put into this, then there are good rational reasons for rejecting the offer to punish you.
But in an anonymous situation where we're not going to interact again, then there's no reason that you need to send a message to me or anything like that. We're not going to meet again.
Right.
So, but what would actually happen in these situations? So say I did offer you $3 out of the $20, what would you do?
I would say, fuck this, asshole. Neither of us are getting anything, right?
Right.
So my desire
would
cost to punish
yourself $3.
Yep, I'm willing to take a hit.
Fuck you.
Yeah, I'm willing to take a hit to tell you to fuck off. And that is an interesting finding. I mean, it speaks volumes about how maybe my emotion of anger kicks in, or maybe my just sense of what the just thing to do is. All kinds of things. But the one thing that it does
it tells you about also your expectations about fairness, right?
Exactly.
Like that, because when you do this experiment with American undergraduates, the average offer is half.
Yeah. I think it's a little, I think it's a little under.
Sorry, that's the median.
It's slightly
that's
under
the most
half.
Common offer.
Right. It's slight. The average is slightly under. I do know, though, that Tamler has played this multiple times and always offers $1.
Why? Because I'm Jewish? Just get it out of the way.
No, it's just a coincidence that you're Jewish.
And then very importantly also, people reject low offers. So people will reject usually any offer below 40%.
Right.
All of this is just a prelude
yeah.
to say that he had the idea as a graduate student of trying to test this across cultures to show that it's not just American college students, but everybody isn't homo economicus. Everybody behaves in this way that is contrary to self-interest if they think they have been treated unfairly. And he went to the Machuganga, this small-scale society in the Peruvian Amazon, and ran these ultimatum game experiments. And what happened was...
I think he made that up. So people named them Machuganga.
Sounds like
something my daughter made up.
Right? Yeah. So he goes there to try to affirm that people behave in this way that's contrary to their self-interest. But what ended up happening was they actually didn't reject any low offers. They behaved more selfishly than American college students. And originally, this was a problem for his theory, although it led to his career and his explosion of fame, because he got a huge MacArthur grant to then go and study the behavior in these kinds of normal economic games in small-scale societies all across the world.
So now, starting with that demonstration that, in fact, when you look at these small-scale societies and compare them to the U.S., you get these radical differences. And so using this sort of takedown, like this, the structure of this demonstration, they, in this BBS article, they went through and said, look, this might be a deeper concern across a number of domains of paradigmatic examples of what the human mind is like. So they go through and they present a review of various findings that actually have these, at least on the face of it, distressing cross-cultural differences.
Should we give some examples?
Yeah, the most powerful one to me is the Mueller-Lyer illusion, which is that you may have seen it in it's a classic visual illusion of visual perception. It's published in a lot of intro psych textbooks. It's two lines with that are actually the exact same length. It's just that the line on top has arrows pointing in toward the line, and the line on the bottom has arrows pointing out, pressed up against the line. I don't know. That's the best way to describe it, but you can
accept that it's the reverse. The one where the arrows are sort of pointing into the line looks significantly longer than
right.
the one the alligators that are pointing
are
whatever
the
go to our website and look at the moonlight.
That's right.
You'll see that one looks significantly longer than the other, even though they're the exact same length.
Right. And while you're on the web, go rate us on iTunes.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to say that. Go rate us on iTunes.
There's a little
bucks.
Middle plug.
We're putting a free podcast out. That's the least you can do, you lazy piece of shit.
I think that this is the most problematic example, because it gets right to one of the most famous claims in cognitive science, which is that if there are any sort of universals in the human mind, one of the best candidates for what would be universal is visual perception. And so there's a famous sort of view of the mind that it's organized by these sort of little sub-processes called modules that just compute information and output it to the more general cognitive system. And they're actually impervious to things like knowledge and belief and desires. that visual perception is one of these things. It's like a little subcomputer. It takes in your visual perception, does some calculation, and then boom, spits it out. And to you and to me, it looks very, very different, even though it's the same. And that's this quirk of the visual perception system. And so it doesn't matter what culture you're raised in, what time period you're raised in. The mind is the mind, and we should expect that everybody falls prey to these visual illusions. So because there's so much, at least evidence that I find compelling that visual perception works this way, it's really like the first time I saw this graph that is in the paper where he plots the strength of the illusion across these different cultures, it kind of blew my mind. So the plot is that if you ask people to estimate the difference in the size, in the length of the lines, it's only Americans who estimate that they're really different. And then you go to some cultures and they're like, no, that just looks the same. There's no difference in the length of those lines. And that still blows my mind. I kind of am like, what the hell? Are they not seeing? Are they not like, are they
even
blind?
Though they're right.
Even like, though what? They're right.
It's like, what's wrong with them?
What's wrong with you not to fall prey to this cognitive illusion?
Yeah.
How do you even walk around without bumping into things that don't exist? So that's low-level perception. Like, that's the shit that the mind is supposed to be good at in the universal sense.
Yeah, and there's a good explanation for that one, right? It's these cultures that, like, we have cultures because we live, in America. Every building we go into has these right angles and stuff like that.
There's not that many right angles in nature.
Yeah, there's not that many right angles in nature. Right. And I guess it's this being accustomed to seeing right angles all the time that is responsible for this illusion.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how, but like I believe that there is some plausible explanation for this. And the others point out, though, that, not every visual illusion – there are some visual illusions that truly are universal, right? So it's
the
not –
the pen like in the water.
Yeah, right.
You having a penis.
Sometimes illusions are powerful, my friend.
Yeah.
I'm like the David Copperfield in here. So it's not to say...
That would be interesting, by the way, is like, could some sort of magicians have trouble? Like if you did a cross-cultural experiment of magicians... Like, you just send Doug Henson, if he's still alive, or David Copperfield. He's probably like 80 now. But, you send them to different cultures. To what extent some of these, various magic tricks of the trade, the diverting of attention and all of that, that would be good.
Yeah.
Copyright Tamler Summers 2013. Nice try. All right.
So, that would be funny if a magician goes to the magic gang and they're like, that's not a trick at all. Before you know it, they have like a little blow dart in their neck and they're just like getting eaten.
They're just getting fed to some.
So, their claim isn't that there's nothing universal. Their claim is simply that we don't have the data. Like, that's the big point. Like, we don't have enough data to conclude yet what is and what isn't.
So let's give a couple other examples, right? So first of all, in those ultimatum games that they did at 15, they found a lot of variation in how people behave in these kinds of economic games that are tied to what their expectations of fairness are. So the Machu Ganga, they just didn't have any kind of expectation of that there would be a fair offer, like a 50-50 offer.
So do you think, though, that if you – I mean, there is something very odd about going to the Magic Ganga and doing an ultimatum game. Don't you think that if they offered, like – if they came up with a game that was – I mean, if what you're trying to test is whether people are uncomfortable with unfairness, don't you think that there's some way in which the situation really isn't – there?
So you're questioning the ecological validity.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean – if you're going to conclude that, it seems very odd to use economic exchanges in these standard economic games. Like if you're like, your buddy Joe has three sticks or five sticks.
I see. I don't think so. I mean, first of all, it wasn't just that, right? So that, there's a lot of other stories that accompany this of when they try to, because they're a kind of society that only gathers together at certain periods of the year, have a lot more trouble cooperating on, say, building a school or something like that than the Fijian population that Henrik studies, where everybody pitches in and that's, you know, considered just the norm, is that's what you do. The cooperative norms of a certain kind with the Machugenga, especially and the certain kind being cooperating with people you don't know that aren't part of your family or a local group, is just very diminished among the Machugenga compared to a lot of other, even other small-scale societies.
But you really think that this is evidence that they don't have an aversion to unfairness, even when they're playing amongst, like, the Machugenga, like, within their in-group? And I mean,
within their in-group, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just unfairness is defined differently. There is no real fairness between groups like there is within groups. Where I think probably their norms are, if anything, more strict. But that's speculation. But the other part isn't speculation.
I guess they wouldn't. I guess I'm just not shocked at all that they're different. There's content that needs to be filled by culture about who is a candidate for fairness and unfairness.
One of the other things, Joseph Henrich's wife. I'm blanking on her name.
Asshole.
I know this is sexist. Dr. Henrich, Natalie Henrich. That's what it is, Natalie Henrich. Well, she did an ethnography. She did some work with the Chaldeans. You know, they have this idea about charity that it's actually morally wrong to give charity to non-Chaldeans. Like, that's actually something that's that is a violation of the norm. But they're a very charitable people, but their charity, you know, we have an idea that charity begins at home. But for them, it's like charity begins and ends at home. And this was so there's a lot of other evidence that there are pretty different conceptions.
Yeah, but that's a very different claim, right? The claim that is made from the data of coming from the ultimatum game isn't that we expect fairness from everybody. It's that in these certain cases we act such that we are acting irrational according to whatever maximums of economic rationality. I think it's a misunderstanding of the claim to say that, right? You could show it that norms differ across groups, right?
Right. That's his point.
Yeah, maybe. We'll get into it, the all-out fight about this.
Let's take a break.
Okay.
Welcome back to Very Bad Wizards. On today's episode, we're talking about Joseph Henrich and colleagues' work on norms. It goes broader than norms.
The universality of the human mind.
The universality.
We actually just had an offline argument about this.
So my interpretation of the results, which I just thought was plainly obvious, but I guess Dave disagrees, is that people across cultures have different fairness norms, by which I mean that what I would consider unfair is different than what someone in the Machugengan culture would consider unfair. So our fairness expectations are different, which doesn't mean that we don't want to be treated fairly, but it's what we count as being treated fairly that differs across cultures. Dave says he disagrees.
Well, yeah, I think that is the point, that we have different fairness norms from other people, and that we might apply the rules of fairness to other people is something that we already knew. That's pretty trivial. I think that actually their claim is much broader than this, much much more basic. And the claim is that the ultimatum game was used to demonstrate that people have a basic aversion to inequity, such that they're willing to sacrifice their self-interest to punish somebody else who they feel has treated them unfairly. Now, it could be that in fact the Machugenga don't have an aversion to inequity, that this isn't a universal feature of the human mind, right? It could very well be that. And it's just that I don't think that they have evidence that this is the case yet. So I think that if you were to run the ultimatum game and manipulate, for instance, whether it was somebody from your own college versus a homeless person or versus a person from another country. Or you might actually show that people have varying responses.
You mean even in America, offers, you would show.
Even in America, right? And there's plenty of social psychology showing, in fact, that we do treat different people differently according to sort of whether we think that they're one of our in-group members or one of our out-group members, and that we apply these norms differently, right? So I think that would be a super modest claim for Joe Henrich to make based on the Machugenga, that they have, that there are different, what we need to find out is whether the Machugenga using, is there any sense in which they would be motivated to violate their own self-interest to punish someone for treating them unfairly? Now, if you could show, if you can't show that, even in the Machugenga, that they actually don't care if their neighbor sort of screws them over, then you would say, look, inequity aversion isn't the universal that we thought it was. And I think this is one reason why I think that this is a bit of an ironic example, because this is the kind of theory testing where something like the ultimatum game works the best. So you say, I have a model of the human mind, that it is rational, and that what I mean by rational is that self-interest trumps. In a clear formulation, $1 is better than zero, and so therefore we should show that people are always motivated, in a very simple scenario, to pick $1 over $0. And you now can falsify this hypothesis in an American population, right? You go to college kids and you show that they, in fact, do not have self-interest trumping their sense of fairness. In fact, their sense of fairness trumps self-interest. Now, of course, there's another question whether everybody in the world has this, but you are comfortable and confident in making the claim that it is not a true feature of the human mind that rationality trumps.
Sure. So in that sense, running the ultimatum game experiment falsifies a thesis, a universalist thesis that had been defended and that was pretty dominant within. At least economic thinking, and I don't know about psychological thinking, but certainly some psychologists subscribe to this view, more or less.
I think maybe this is a point where I can bring up the MOOC article. So there's an article by a psychologist named Douglas MOOC.
Before you bring this up, let me just tell you a piece of news that you might be interested in, and then we'll get back to this paper that you have a hard-on for, and that is that they just chose a new pope.
Ooh.
And that pope is from your home country. He's from Buenos Aires.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy crap!
So congratulations.
They should have put a little more effort into that. A
couple more days of black smoke, but
as much as I love Argentinians, let's just say we're high on the corruption index.
That's true.
You know what, though? If Argentina doesn't win the World Cup, then I know there is no God.
That's true. Although, this could be one of those, like, you know, again, this kind of game theory thing where the Pope is going to know that people are thinking that and... That didn't make any sense at all. So let's get back to this paper by Douglas MOOC you think anticipated the Henrich objection and responded decisively to it.
Well, yeah, because the Henrich objection isn't new, right? The Henrich is new in that it finally has cross-cultural data. The Henrich paper is a great, wonderful call to do more cross-cultural studies because it is important. But let me see if, in a nutshell, I can summarize MOOC's argument, which is, and I'll put a link to this paper as well. It was published in 1983, but I think it's a little gem of a paper. It's called "In Defense of External Invalidity," and so he points out that this concern, this threat to psychology and the social sciences, maybe that we are conducting studies that are externally invalid, sounds so daunting, right? Because who wouldn't want to be valid, as he points out. But really, the concern is about generalizability, and that is, when we demonstrate something in the lab, how can we be sure that it is true of all human beings? And it sounds like a very right kind of concern to have, but in reality, it's usually not the case that that's ever the goal of a lab study. As MOOC, I think, nicely points out, it's not that we're generalizing about humanity based on one case. It's that we're starting with a general claim. We're starting with a universal sort of general claim about the human mind, and we're bringing it into the lab to test it. And so what you can do is you could actually falsify a general claim. So he points to these Harlow monkey studies, right?
Yeah, these which he calls elegantly constructed. Yeah, it's so elegant to just shock a baby monkey, to put it by something that it thinks is its mom and just give it a huge electric shock and then watch it go back to this thing. That motherfucker,
is that guy still alive?
I don't care. Like, somebody should kick the living shit out of that guy. Somebody should attach him to one of his to one of those shock things.
Do you feel this way about people who eat meat?
I feel this way about Harlow and this experiment. This experiment pissed me off so much. Like, when I read about this experiment, I was stomping around my house throwing things. I was so mad about this experiment. I don't want to hear shit about how this experiment, an example of good psychology in action. It was an example of good monkey torturing, baby monkey torturing in action. That's what this experiment was. I'm so pissed off about this.
I'm glad you are now a vegetarian.
And you know what the worst thing is? About this is that he never explains what the fuck this experiment was supposed to show. Like, he just
the burden is on Mook now to teach you basic intro psych.
This is what Harlow
You should read an intro psych book.
Harlow did not conclude wild monkeys in the jungle probably would choose terry cloth over wire monkeys too if offered the choice. Like, so he didn't conclude that, as if like that was the criticism, that he did conclude that.
Well, do you understand the argument by analogy that's the criticism of many lab studies?
That what? No. Okay, so sorry. I had to get that off my chest because I can't be a part.
I'm intrigued now at your aversion to the suffering of animals.
We'll talk about how vegetarian, consistent or inconsistent I might be on that front. But but that's not the subject of this. So go back and talk to the.
So, from Harlow's monkeys, I think that as a demonstration, it's pretty obvious that he wasn't trying to generalize that it in the wild monkeys will prefer cloth to wire. Right, he was trying to test a particular hypothesis about attachment and the giving of food, right, as nourishment, and with this albeit inhumane study, and actually Harlow, I have it on good authority that Harlow was in fact an asshole, and very very low on empathy, but I thought that you would find a kindred spirit in him.
I'll have no empathy when he gets his ass kicked.
He's dead. He's dead.
Good.
You won.
No, did he? Was it a painful death or was it?
It was actually a bunch of monkeys got the wire and just formed it into a shiv and just stabbed him multiple times.
I'd love that.
so it would be weird to conclude that in fact was the goal of Harlow's studies and that it was therefore a failed goal, because that wasn't the goal. Like, it was very different. So Mook says, in many cases lab studies have goals that are not about generalizability at all. They're not trying to infer the truth about all human beings from what they show in the lab. What they're trying to do is often cases falsify a hypothesis that you ought to see this in everybody, or simply demonstrate something, an existence proof, demonstrate that something in fact can happen. Say you want to demonstrate the limits of memory. If you have a theory that says the limits of memory are, say, 5 chunks of information, and you bring people into the lab and you show, in fact, 20% of people can memorize 20 chunks of information, that is a valuable piece of information. So Mook points out the various cases in which it would be weird to assume that our goal was to conclude on the basis of a lab study something just that should be observed across all human beings. So there's a quote. Since you're always reading quotes, I'm going to read one, which I think is the
well, because it requires research. That's why you haven't been doing it up till this point in our.
Well, what I've always noticed when I always notice when you read is that it also requires reading ability. So I'm going to just show people how I can read clearly without stuttering. So Mook says, everyone knows that we make experimental settings artificial for a reason. We do it to control for extraneous variables and to permit separation of factors that do not come separately in nature as you find it. But that leaves us wondering how, having stepped out of nature, we get back in again. How do our findings apply to the real life setting in all its complexity? I think there are times when the answer has to be, they don't. But we then may add, something else does. It is called understanding. I think that is the gist of his argument, which is, you can discover a lot about the human mind from very constrained settings. And I think most of psychology actually has this as its goal. Now, I agree, though, that, as you said in the beginning, we often end our articles with some claim about, you know, this shows something about human nature. But we're just wrong in our in the way that we talk about it.
You're just trying to self-promote.
Yeah, well, to put it bluntly, we're trying to make our findings seem important in this sort of generalizability kind of way.
Right.
When in fact, I think we ought to just admit that that was never our goal in the first place.
Okay, so let me ask you about that. So, yeah. And I'll use an example from this article that you love so much. This is a study that I can fully support because it involves giving people access to alcohol. And yeah. So he says he was testing the hypothesis that alcohol reduces tension. And so here is an experiment. Now, this is a great example of what he's talking about, where that is a universal claim, right, about what alcohol is for. So that if you can conduct an experiment where it's a tense situation but people don't drink alcohol, then, you know, that may falsify it. But here's where the external validity, I think, can come into play. So in this experiment, as he describes it, this is Higgins and Marlick, 1973, and I will try to read this without
studying. Were you like 10 years old when this got published?
Briefly, the subjects were... I was just 2 years old, actually. Briefly, the subjects were made either highly anxious or not so anxious by the threat of electric shock. What would you do as psychologists if you couldn't just shock primates, people, or animals? It would be really tough for you.
Well, here we're just threatening them.
By the threat of electric shock, and were permitted access to alcohol as desired. If alcohol reduces tension, and if people drink it because it does so, then the anxious subjects should have drunk more, and they did not. Now, here's where I think ecological validity has some serious relevance, right? Because the kind of tension, when people say that people drink alcohol to reduce tension that you're talking about, right, is really important, right? Tension that alcohol tends to reduce, or that, say, I would think, from my layman's perspective, that alcohol can help with, and thank God for it, right, is the kind of tension that is tension that accompanies your day, right? It's not the kind of tension that you would get in a lab, and especially in a lab where you don't know what they're doing to you. You don't know what the effects of an electric shock are. You don't know if you should be drinking alcohol or not drinking alcohol. This is these are two different categories. That tension, yeah. It might be a kind of tension, and the kind of tension that I think people think alcohol, and rightly think, alcohol can help reduce. And so that's where, although he hates the term, he calls it, what does he call it, a per term or something like that, external validity, that's one where if you're going to falsify a theory, right, you need to falsify it with what the theory is actually making a claim toward. No one has the hypothesis that we drink alcohol when we're afraid that we're about to get electric shocks.
I'm so glad, Tamler, that you raised this concern.
Good.
Because it gets to a very, very critical distinction, which is your concern is not about external validity at all. It's about internal validity. And what you're pointing to is that the manipulation of tension that they used is not the right manipulation of tension. Now, it could be that there's a theory that says, by tension, I simply mean any anxiety, whether it be lab or not. So you could say, well, look, this lab manipulation induced anxiety, but it didn't induce the kind of tension that my theory actually predicts.
Right.
Or it could be that that it doesn't even induce anxiety. So your concern is about the measure, about the manipulation itself, and whether that's capturing what the theory predicts. Now, imagine that you came up with a better manipulation of anxiety and tension, and that you actually had a very sort of nuanced manipulation where you told people that their exam was sooner than they thought it was going to be. It's still within the same limited population, but it is actually a closer manipulation of the kind of tension that we're talking about. Then you could conclude that you had falsified the hypothesis, or you had provided evidence that in fact tension did increase. But that's a very different concern than external validity. Whether you're still in terms of external validity, you could still only generalize to
no. But I thought external validity was not about generalizability. It was about is this the thing that we're actually talking about out in the world? I thought, as Mook says, that could
external validity is generalizability.
No, He says, in fact, that sometimes something can be externally valid but not generalizable because it would be different across cultures, that those are two different things. Application to the real world is external validity, but that doesn't mean the real world every place in the world. It just means the real world someplace in the world.
Right. But your concern is actually about whether or not the induction of tension is a valid induction of tension, and that's right. An internal validity concern. Right. So you admit that you, so long as you had a good manipulation, all you're saying is that this wasn't a real test of the hypothesis because they used the wrong induction of anxiety.
Yeah. But it wasn't a real falsification because they used a bad measure of tension, and specifically not the kind of tension that in the real world we use alcohol. Maybe they don't do this in other countries, but that people say in America use alcohol to try to alleviate.
Yeah. So it could be that their theory just posited that by tension they mean the kind of tension induced from daily stressors and from the threat of electric shock in the lab, in which case this would be a valid manipulation.
But here's where I think what is the point of the experiment if it's not externally valid as I defined it and as I think as he defines it? What's the point of this experiment? What does it show? It shows that something we didn't believe was the case and that has no application in real life isn't the case. Then who cares?
Well, let's separate out the two criticisms then. Because one is, suppose that they used a different manipulation of tension.
Right.
Right. That they could use in the lab. So it could be that it's just bad science because they didn't capture what we mean. It would be like if I did a study and I was like, we induced disgust in 30 participants. And when I say we induced disgust, I mean we made them read Dr. Seuss's Cat in the Hat, right? And you'd be like, well, that's not an induction of disgust, at least not what I mean by disgust. That seems like the criticism that you're leveling on this. That's not tension the way I mean it, right? That's not tension the way I would have heard. And so that's a very different – that's not about external validity.
That one
is. It's true. Right, yeah. Right. So the question, though, that if you had like a decent manipulation of disgust or one of tension – and you still fail to find those results, I think you could conclude something. That is, we can't say that universally tension causes an increase in alcohol, but it could be that in some cases it does, and then you just proceed. And it's a slower progress than we might want, but it's progress.
But you have to – I completely agree, right? So then the question, though, is you want to design your experiment so that at least it makes progress – towards some sort of insight about human psychology. It doesn't have to be universal human psychology, but some sort of human psychology as it manifests itself in everyday life, in real life, or at least in real life.
I mean, it doesn't – so it could be – so like let's take priming experiments. So I prime you with some, you know, some subliminal flash of a smile on your computer screen. And now I show that you are more likely to give your teacher good ratings this afternoon.
Ooh, right? Can you do that?
So, yeah, maybe. Now, it would be weird to say, dude, no one gets smiley faces flashed, right? That's a weird thing to – that would be a weird claim to make. Like, that's – I don't know why people are fucking around with subliminal flashing of smiley faces. When does that ever happen? I don't care if it increases teacher ratings because that's not what I mean. But in fact, that gives us a real good insight into how the mind works, that it is processing some stimuli, sub-threshold, in the absence of other overt, you know, countervening forces that might actually give rise to different judgment. And so that says something about the description of the human mind. And it may never truly describe a situation that was ever found in the real world. But
okay, good. But so that's a great example. I actually think we're making more.
I know,
I'm so progress than we normally do. This is weird.
This feels awkward.
Don't.
It's like we had good sex for the first time ever.
Don't expect
after being married.
Don't expect exactly. This is like the Kama Sutra of our podcast. I agree with you that would be an interesting result. But part of the reason it's an interesting result is because, A, people really do...
because you want to flash smiley faces for your class.
Yeah, because that is something that people have interest in, right? Getting good evaluations on their teaching evaluations. I mean, you don't care because you have tenure. And I guess I have tenure too, but I still care about teaching. But and not only that, but if that really worked, you know, that would be something that you could manipulate and you could use not just for teacher ratings, but for advertising, yeah, for ratings of movies on IMDb or Netflix or something like that.
It's true. It's true. But here's the problem, which is there is such a temptation to conclude this. And it does seem that is where the mind goes naturally. That is to say, like, how can I use this in real life? But in reality, reality is so messy that, like, in the time between getting a smiley face subliminally flashed, you might be at a movie theater and they flash something subliminally in your theater is like, and your girlfriend is holding your hand so you can't go get a drink or something, or, you know, there are all kinds of reasons that these things might not work in the real world, but that doesn't mean that it didn't shed light on how the mind works. But I think that this general point, though, that you raise is critical to understanding why this is controversial at all, which is, I think we want to conclude that the goal of these studies is to say something true about the real world. And I think that we're doing a bad job as scientists of communicating this. We do end our papers by saying, like, right, and this points to, like, some real world phenomena that might be of interest. What if you got a subliminal smiley face flashed at you when you're in the movie theater?
Right.
You know?
And which is why also you get written up in Slate and you get written up in the New York Times and you get, exactly, and David Brooks writes most of his columns about the work of you know, Jonathan Haidt and other psychologists. Yeah. And, yeah.
Right. And so I'll give you an example from art. So we did a study. This was with Eric Helzer, where we had people fill out a political questionnaire next to a hand sanitizer or not. The wrong thing to conclude is that, therefore, political attitudes are shaped largely by whether or not you're standing next to a hand. I think this is a fleeting, small effect. I think that it probably lasted like 3 minutes tops. I don't think that it would influence voting behavior. I don't think that it would be a good strategy for the Republican Party to put hand sanitizers in the commercials.
Right.
I think it just says something interesting about the way the mind works. And in particular, I think that temporarily stimulating people's thoughts about disease and disease avoidance can shift the way they think about the world, albeit in a small way. And so I always resist when people are like, oh, so how can we use this? Because I'm like, probably not at all.
Right.
You know, and if it were the case that that actually caused people to vote Republican, fuck, we're screwed. like, we're fucking screwed. But I think we just need to do a better job of embracing the fact that most of our shit isn't applicable directly like that.
But at least, again, that one, you're right. I mean, this is maybe, there's not going to be a hard and fast rule about this, but that one is, it does say something interesting about how the mind works. Whereas, I don't think the alcohol study does. I don't think,
no,
A, it tells us anything about that particular hypothesis, or B, tells us anything interesting about how the mind works. It just – it really doesn't tell us much more than people in this kind of situation aren't more likely to drink alcohol than people, you know, who are
– Yeah. You know, it might have been, it would have been more informative had it shown a positive result, like had they actually demonstrated a real –
Right. Thing. Exactly.
And that's why it's a weird example to give. But they wouldn't know that before, like, going into it, right?
Right.
That's so true. It's true that you can conclude more from a significant finding than you can from a null finding.
But, all right. So I think we need to make this a part two, right?
Yeah, maybe we can keep talking about culture more broadly.
Yeah, we won't necessarily talk about this particular debate, but we'll talk about different – because I actually have – there's more stuff I want to say. We didn't mention –
especially when it comes to ethics. I'm really curious about what –
Yeah, let's – maybe the next time we'll see how some of this might apply specifically to ethics. I can't believe we didn't mention how he leads off the weird paper by the description of the children who ingest the semen – of their elders in this tribe, and he's not doing it like his point.
It's almost like a philosopher.
In contrast, the nearby Kaluli maintain that the male initiation is only properly done by ritually delivering the semen through the initiate's anus, not his mouth. And hey, this relates to they just chose a new pope, right?
Oh, that's a good one. On that note, we should probably end it. Rate us on iTunes, buy Amazon, through our link.
Oh yeah, go on Amazon, buy your expensive items by pressing that link, and then everything you buy on Amazon we would get a little cut of, and we can use to improve the
quality.
Should
say actually show. Yeah, actually Bunny Sandifer, who is a fan of ours on the Very Bad Wizards page and is an audio geek and gave us lots of good feedback. And on the basis of her feedback, I started doing some research into some audio gear. And we would like to do interviews in person. And we found like this awesome piece of audio gear. It's like $300 and we're poor.
Yeah.
So So buy a plasma.
And all, you don't have to give us any money. You just have to buy what you would normally buy on Amazon.
That's right.
And rate us on iTunes. All right, thanks. Join us next time for part two, we think, of this episode of Very Bad Wizards.
For more information about this episode, including show notes and links, and to listen to other episodes, please visit us at www.verybadwizards.com.
Very bad man. I'm a very good man. Good man. They think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have. Pay no attention to that man. Anybody can have a brain. Good man, just a very bad wizard.
Oh, dude, you have got to edit that out.
I promise.